Our next speaker, after which we'll have questions from the floor. And by the way, at that point, if you would go to the two microphones that are provided, and we'll take you in the order which you appear there, and if you'll state your name. But our next speaker is George Gilger. He is best known in our circles for his fundamental studies, Men and Marriage and Wealth and Poverty. He is a pioneer of supply-side economics and more recently has been a leading analyst of the impact of emerging technologies on the economy but also on individual lives. He's a fellow at Seattle's Discovery Institute and is a contributing editor at Forbes magazine. His most recent book is Telecosm and How Infinite Bandwidth Will Revolutionize Our World. Would you welcome George Gilger?
Thank you, Ken. This is a great celebration, 40 years of the Philadelphia Society, devoted to the concept of ordered liberty under God. And through this, it reconciles the two great themes of conservative thought, free markets and transcendent order. Economic freedom and cultural stability. And Bill Buckley caught this reconciliation very early in his first book, God and Man at Yale, which was an attack on atheistic socialism that was taught at Yale during his time there. And he focused on the atheism as much as the socialism. They both reflected the same fundamental disorder or fallacy. And Midge Dechter, your new president, has led me through a crucial transition of a book project I was doing called The Pursuit of Poverty at the time. And the pursuit of poverty was transformed into Wealth and Poverty under Midge's guidance. Crucially, when she gave me a copy of pre-publication copy of Jude Winiski's The Way the World Works. And he grasped the supply side, but perhaps not the deeper links to transcendent order. The key focus of Wealth and Poverty was to reconcile these two sometimes conflicting branches of conservatism. Now at the Discovery Institute with my friend of 40 or more years, maybe it's, I don't know how many years, Bruce Chapman, we are again carrying this essential concept of ordered liberty, this reconciliation of cultural conservatism and economic conservatism forward with a focus on my part on science and technology, the implications of the new findings in science and technology for a deeper understanding of the themes of ordered liberty. And I think there have been two great findings of 20th century thought that are deeply relevant to this theme of ordered liberty in politics and society. Two great scientific findings. One is information theory. Now, information theory was conceived by Claude Shannon at MIT and Bell Labs in the late 1940s. And he was focusing on determining how much information could be transmitted down a particular communications channel. And the key insight was that information, real information, consists of surprise. And he measured surprise as in terms of what he called entropy, and an analogy to a concept in physics. But the crucial insight was that information is not equilibrium but disequilibrium. Information is not predictable data. Information is unexpected data. Information is news, what you don't expect. And a crucial insight of information theory, absolutely central, is that it takes a low entropy carrier to bear a high entropy message. In other words, you have to have a predictable carrier in order to bear a lot of information. And that's why virtually the entire information economy rides on the electromagnetic spectrum, on worldwide webs of glass and light. And light, which is a form of electromagnetic energy, is perfectly predictable. It's predictable sine waves. And the key to transmitting lots of information is to have a perfectly predictable vessel of that information. And although this information theory was designed for communication systems, it also applies fully to economic systems. And what you need is economic systems that are predictable, that can bear a lot of the good news, the unexpected boons of human creativity, which is a surprise to us. If creativity was not surprising, you could plan it and socialism would prevail. But creativity always comes as a surprise to us. That's what defines this, defines it. It is news. It is the unexpected data. It's and in order to have an environment that can result in the surprises of human creativity, you need to have a predictable, stable environment of law, stable families, stable money, stable property. And these are essential to a productive economy. So that is information theory is an absolutely vital finding that underlies almost the entire information economy, does underlie the information economy. And it also fully supports the Philadelphia Society's concept of ordered liberty. But equally, and the crucial point is that an economy is an information system, not a material system. And so it's ruled by the laws of information, not by the laws of matter. And that is a critical insight. And a second key discovery about information during the 20th century was Kurt Gödel's demonstration and Gödel's proof that no mathematical system is coherent or self-sufficient in itself. Any mathematical or logical system is necessarily dependent on premises beyond itself and irreducible to the system. In other words, this Gödel's proof sustains the second great theme of ordered liberty, of transcendent order under God. And indeed, Kurt Gödel imagined that he was proving the existence of God. This, you can read a lot about Kurt Gödel without understanding this fact. But my daughter, who's just written a 300,000-word book on physics that's just been accepted by Knopf in New York, a 25-year-old daughter, discovered this about Gödel in the course of researching her book on entanglement theory, but I won't go into that. But every logical system every method, and ultimately all logic is reducible to mathematical propositions, is dependent on a premises beyond itself. And order is necessarily transcendent. It's not reductionist, and that is the critical insight. It is hierarchical, not reductionist. So this means that, that the world began not in a primordial soup. It began in the beginning was the Word, not a primordial soup. And these divergent themes of conservatism, the ordered liberty and transcendent order, really have been fully and deeply confirmed by the most important scientific discoveries of the 20th century. And a lot of conservatives sort of adopt an intuitive resistance to the discoveries of science without a full grasp of how deeply they affirm conservative insights and how the leftist scientism is, and sort of materialist reductionism, has been completely overthrown by the 20th century scientific discoveries. Well, so information is disequilibrium, not equilibrium. And this is one of the problems of much economics, because economists always tend to favor equilibrium. They seem to believe that somehow the correct system is always in balance. But I believe that science tells you that economies should have balance, law, families, all these property rights, money, but the basic forces of growth are disequilibrium. And the effort to reduce economics to equilibria is deadly and destructive. And I think it took a long time for the Republican Party really to recognize this fact. I mean, for a long time, the Republican Party resisted lower tax rates in the name of a totem of a balanced budget from the time of Hoover through Eisenhower and Nixon and Ford, and equilibrium economics prevailed. And it wasn't really until Ronald Reagan that we had a president who reconciled these two great principles of ordered liberty and brought disequilibrium to the fore. Now, a couple years ago, I gave a speech to the Philadelphia Society explaining how Reagan that there are a lot of myths about Ronald Reagan's regime. He did not reduce spending, of course. Most people know that. But more important, he understood that economics is not a zero-sum proposition. You lower the rates and the regulations and render them more predictable and stable, and you get more revenues and more creativity, entrepreneurial creativity. There's a popular conservative half-truth that is worth confronting, and that half-truth is that the burden of government is represented not by tax rates, but by spending levels. This seems like an innocent misconception, that somehow the best way to calculate the burden of government is by the total spending levels. But this is a profoundly wrong proposition. Indeed, it is only with low tax rates that a nation can sustain the levels of spending necessary to support the defense and national security that is necessary to defend ordered liberty. And for the entire 40 years of the Philadelphia Society's existence, countries with low or declining tax rates have been able to increase their government spending 3 times faster than countries with high or rising tax rates. If you want low absolute levels of government spending, the best thing to do is to enact high tax rates and oppressive regulations, because these will succeed in suppressing the surprises of entrepreneurial creativity on which human triumph always depends. Just before I left for this meeting, I picked up a latest copy of Regulation Magazine, which is the Cato Institute's publication, and they emblazoned across the cover of this magazine was an attack on Bush's tax cuts. Said they caused terrible disequilibrium and would ultimately be deeply destructive to the economy. And the problems that these tax cuts would cause, according to Cato, were a budget deficit, implicitly a trade gap, a social security and generational catastrophe, and all these assumptions, which a supposedly libertarian organization could propound and emblazon as their key insight cover story, are all just totally misconceived. All these things. A trade gap means a capital surplus, and you want a balance. You know, this article implies that balance is good for trade and budgets and stuff, but a balanced tires or a balanced diet, they're deeply desirable. But a balance of trade or a balanced budget is not necessarily desirable at all. Indeed, a trade gap signifies a capital surplus. It means that people want to send us money. It means they trust the stability and order of the U.S. economy. You can see how this works when you realize that 1/3 of global GDP is in the United States. The United States generates fully 1/3 of global GDP. But the market caps of our companies represent 57% of global market cap. In other words, people all over the world want to invest in the United States. And this is because the United States has the most stable environment for investment. It has the deepest and most creative capital markets. It's got the largest and most liquid stock markets. Has the rule of law, we hope, rather than the rule of lawyers, which threaten it. So the capital surplus, you know, the way to think of this is a foreigner with a dollar can do 2 things with it. He can buy an American good, buy an apple exported from the United States, for example, or it can buy an asset in the United States. And if he purchases the apple, he eats it, and we don't have it anymore. He purchases the asset in the United States, and we keep it. And he registers a deeper commitment to America than he does in buying an apple. or a side of beef or any other kind of or any other kind of American product. And this is why the when we begin to run a trade surplus, I begin to worry. The last real trade surplus we had was about 1978, that was in the midst of a terrible crisis when people no longer trusted the American dollar or the reliability of the of American economic leadership under the Carter years and Ford years, unfortunately. The budget deficit is a similar proposition. The budget deficit is $500 billion. That's not nice on the surface, but it's dwarfed by the increase in American assets that has simultaneously occurred as the deficit increased. While the budget deficit increased to $500 billion, we had $5 or $6 trillion increase in assets. And one of the problems with many economists is they can count liabilities, but they can't count assets. They're one-armed economists, as they say. And the net assets of American households now are some $42 or $43 trillion. And the gross assets are $50 trillion. The assets of the total economy are over $60 trillion. And in the context of these huge asset numbers, the $500 billion deficit in the federal budget is actually a trivial factor. It's dwarfed by changes in the value of assets. And indeed, it's a lot easier to, the balance of payments is governed chiefly by capital movements in the modern economy. Capital can move much more quickly and readily than can goods, which face all sorts of obstacles of distance. And so it's capital movements that drive it. And if the United States has favorable environment for capital, we will tend to thrive regardless of the budget deficit of this order. But if the United States has bad and destructive economic policies, it won't matter what kind of budget balance we achieve at the same time. It's not just overseas holders of dollars who will try to sell them, but domestic holders of dollars. The idea that there's something special about Chinese or Japanese who hold dollars that differentiates them from Americans who hold dollars is misconceived. George Soros and Warren Buffett can sell dollars just as fast and as efficiently as any one in China or Japan or Europe. It's what's critical is to maintain the institutions of ordered liberty in the United States. The Social Security crisis, as it were, is similar. What it essentially means is we're living longer. That's the essence of it, and that's a good thing entirely. And as we live longer and are healthier, we can be more productive for more years. And the solution to the problem of productivity among old people is really information technology, which you can do indoor work with no heavy lifting in the contemporary economy, and even if your sight and hearing is deteriorating, you still can, with the advances in contemporary technology continue to be a productive contributor to the U.S. economy. And so this sort of catastrophe theory that there'll be too few workers to support old people as time passes is just a misconception. And indeed, a further solution, of course, is Professor Harberger's, which is implemented in Chile, of allowing a great private pension component to the Social Security system, and you hope that ultimately the private system will thrive enough to render the public deficit irrelevant. So the real solution is entrepreneurial creativity, which is a force of disequilibrium, creative destruction, said Schumpeter. And this is a great year, a great era of entrepreneurial creativity in the United States. The latest data is fascinating on this subject. The proportion of total jobs, which represents self-employment or limited liability corporations as a share of total employment, has risen from 5% in the middle 1980s. Only 5% of all jobs in the household survey were self-employment or proprietors, individual proprietorships. And during the 1990s, it rose to 9%. But today, during the first years of 15% capital gains taxes and 15% dividend taxes, 31% of all employment in the household survey is self-employment and entrepreneurial employment of this kind. And one of the problems with the dismal science, what makes it dismal, is that economists always tend to ignore the entrepreneur. And thank the Lord, the entrepreneurs ignore the economists, so we can get some of the life and surprise of disequilibrium. That's conventional sort of demand economics that still prevails widely through the U.S. academy and media. So, and one of the points about the entrepreneur is the triumph of the entrepreneur is ultimately a moral triumph as well as merely a material triumph, because he ultimately is an information agent. And the essential rule of enterprise is the golden rule. The good fortune of others is always your own. That's the fundamental principle of capitalism, where you get rich by serving others, and where you above all hope that others succeed, and where always the biggest untapped market is the poor, the billions of people around the world who are now at last ascending toward the bounties of ordered freedom that the Philadelphia Society upholds. It's not greed or self-interest, but the service of others that propels the advances of capitalism. Equilibrium economics is an economics of death. Disequilibrium, entrepreneurial economics, the economics of surprise and creativity is the economics of life. And the key message of ordered liberty is choose life. Thank you very much.